Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com. All right, Congress is going to have this debate, but we should all be having this debate about health care in our country, along with Congress, with each other. And it ought to be civil, but there's a lot of politics involved in this, and that's unfortunate. We got to ask some core questions about health care in this country. And one is, and we'll address that today, the cost of it. Are we really addressing the cost of health care? I don't know. The ACA, Obamacare, just subsidizes insurance. And how do we flip the switch on that? Those are questions to ask here, too. And I get down to it in terms of, you know, are these subsidies a necessary safety net? The difference between a safety net and maybe a costly crutch for this country as well. We'll talk about that today in great detail. Mark Goldwine joins us here, Senior Vice President and Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Let me say that again. Responsible Federal Budget today on Voices of Montana. Amongst my favorites, welcome Mark Goldwine here as we get into this discussion. I could lay out a little bit of the parameters here and what we're going to be talking about, but I'm going to have Mark do it and then talk about his organization, Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, CRFB.org. Obamacare is not the only thing, and healthcare is not the only thing that they address. There's a number of issues, and I really appreciate Mark coming alongside here. Mark, good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. We'll get into the cost, your actual cost. That for me is an important part of this discussion that Congress is going to have here. But you guys deal with so much as well. Talk about your organization and what you guys' goals are.
Yeah, thank you for asking. So the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget has been around since about 1980. And we are a nonpartisan think tank. And when I say nonpartisan, I actually mean it. Our board is Democrats, Republicans, Independents. They disagree on a lot, but they all agree we can't have a federal budget that's out of control. We can't have a debt that is rising forever faster than the economy. And so we produce research, analysis, policy development, all towards furthering the idea that people need to have a better understanding of our nation's fiscal picture. And we think with that better understanding, maybe they'll start to act a little bit more responsibly.
Yeah, I appreciate that, too. Again, Mark has got a lot of experience here, previously associate director on the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform. That was from the Simpson-Bowles Commission there. Previously a senior budget analyst for the Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction. So you've been at this for quite some time here, Mark. Give us your initial thoughts on a responsible federal budget and healthcare.
Sure. Well, let's start at the beginning.
Yeah.
The federal government is running $2 trillion annual deficits, $2 trillion a year. Our debt as a share of the economy is about 100%. It's only ever been that high once, right after World War II. And unlike after World War II, it is now projected to grow unsustainably and indefinitely. There's lots of reasons for that growth. Fundamentally, we keep cutting taxes. We keep increasing spending. So those numbers are getting further apart. But one major factor underlying it is that some of our largest federal programs are healthcare programs, and healthcare is growing faster than basically anything else in the economy. And so Medicare, which provides healthcare to seniors, Medicaid, which provides healthcare to low income, and to a much lesser extent by cost, Obamacare, which provides healthcare for sort of moderate income folks. These are expensive programs and their costs are growing rapidly. That's a problem for the beneficiaries who see their premiums and cost sharing go up, but it's especially a problem for the taxpayer who's bearing most of these costs and passing along to future generations through higher and higher debt.
Well, how do you respond to those initially would say, you know, well, modern monetary theory tells us not to worry about debt. Everybody is in debt and it's all just relative. And I counter that, you know, production is what leads to profit or wealth, not things on paper. But, you know, what's your response to that aspect of this conversation?
Well, look, it's true that what really matters is what our economy can produce. That's true. Everybody understands that. But what we can produce is intricately related to our ability to finance it. And we had a test case of modern monetary theory. Basically, the idea is deficits don't matter, or debt doesn't matter. Borrow as much as you want. Keep interest rates at zero and everything will be okay. We had a test case in 2020 and 2021 with COVID, right? And what did we see? Massive inflation. In fact, inflation is still not under control 4 or 5 years later. And so we know that doesn't work. We know from the research, from observation, from the theory that higher debt pushes up interest rates. That makes borrowing costs more expensive. We know that it slows income growth. Unless your debt is really bad, it doesn't stop income growth. So we're still wealthier. We're still growing income, but we're growing at a slower pace. And we know it's not sustainable. We know the United States is a very strong economy, and we can hold debt. We can bear debt, but we can't bear unlimited amounts of debt. And if the debt keeps growing faster than the economy, at some point, something will break.
How much of that is received, not only by Congress, the branches of government, but by the people of this country?
You know, I think that the vast majority of politicians and people understand you can't spend infinitely more than you raise in revenue. I think that's widely understood. The problem is people want three things. They want more government benefits and services, they want lower taxes, and they want less debt. And those three things are in conflict, and politicians don't want to tell them the truth, right? And so they do things like pretend a tax cut pays for itself, or pretend a new expensive spending policy actually doesn't cost very much, or pretend that borrowing is free with modern monetary theory. Politicians don't want to tell them the truth because politicians don't want to lose elections. And they think that if they force the public to understand trade-offs, public's not going to like it. I think this is a very low opinion of the American public. When we've kind of done focus groups and polling, and just when I go out into the country and talk to people, they're willing to make trade-offs. Mm-hmm. They don't want to make sacrifice on their own, right? They want it to be shared sacrifice. They don't want to do it for no reason. But I think people are willing to wrestle with trade-offs. Politicians just aren't willing to be honest with them.
Yeah, and I appreciate that kind of honesty as well. And we have to confront that as a public here, because it's on us. In my mind, you know, with the political nature of what's going to happen here in a couple of weeks when we try to debate possibly another continuing resolution or get on with a real budget, there's going to be a lot of smoke and mirrors, as noted. And so I appreciate a conversation like this. What is the core problem?
I mean, there's not one core problem, but I think if I had to point to somebody, I'd point to the politicians, as I said before. Like, the core problem is we don't have the politics, right, is that we're not going to make the tough choices. But within the budget, I think we're kind of wrestling with three major issues and many, many minor issues. The one I already mentioned to you is rising healthcare costs. The second is the aging of the population. As we get older, more and more money is going to Social Security and to Medicare, because that's a program for seniors. And the third is the unwillingness of the politicians to pay for it, and in fact, the exuberance of politicians to do the exact opposite, right? And so you would think, seeing how bad the deficit and debt is, there would have been a big legislation this year to get it under control. Instead, there was a gigantic tax cut that made the debt worse. It's not that tax cuts are bad. It's not that spending is bad. But tax cuts are bad when they're not paid for, because it's not really a tax cut then. It's just a tax shift from current generations who get to enjoy it to future generations who will pay the cost.
Mark Goldwine, our guest here, CRFB.org. That's the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, again, since 1980. But a lot of work, Mark, you've done on fiscal responsibility prior and leading into that. So, you know, I appreciate that. Let's get into this core question about healthcare in this country. And I think a lot of people are landing on it, and you have, as we chatted earlier as well, and that is the cost of health care versus the cost of health insurance. Obamacare, I don't know, did it make the system broken, so to speak, or how do we address a broken system by focusing?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think that both sides use a lot of hyperbole here. Mm-hmm. Obamacare didn't break the healthcare system. Obamacare didn't save the healthcare system. Obamacare made a lot of changes to the healthcare system. Some of them good, some of them bad, most of them very complicated. But one thing it did is it took people that currently are not able to get insurance through their employer, and it created these exchanges where you can buy insurance in an individual market and not be need to be worried about being paid. Not need to worry about being turned down because of adverse health history or because of age, because of exuberant costs. And to make that affordable, it created these subsidies to help people pay for that insurance. But again, subsidizing doesn't reduce cost, it shifts cost. And so what we've decided to do under Obamacare and under this recent expansion is to say everybody else is going to pay a little more so that these folks can pay a little bit less. And whether you think that's good or bad is a value judgment. What I'm focused on is how do we finance it and how do we make sure it's done efficiently? And right now I'd say it's not horribly inefficient, but it's not being done efficiently. And there's substantial room for improvement. And just throwing more money after bad is probably not the way to go.
Where can we reduce healthcare costs?
Yeah. So within the Obamacare exchanges, something we can start with is something they're actually going to vote on today. It's a pretty good idea. And this is so in the weeds, but I'm going to try to explain as best I can.
We're used to that. Go ahead.
Yeah. These are called cost-sharing reductions. And here's the basic idea. There's two types of subsidies in Obamacare. There's a subsidy for your premiums. And so we'll cover some of your premium costs. And then there's a subsidy if you're low income for your out-of-pocket costs, your co-pays, your co-insurance. The law intended that the federal government would pay both. But there was a drafting error in the law. And so it turns out the insurance companies actually have to pay that second subsidy. What do the insurance companies do? They just jack up their premiums on everyone, and then the federal government ends up paying a bigger premium subsidy. But they're not just paying a bigger premium subsidy for those low-income people. They're actually paying a bigger premium subsidy for everyone. And so we have this thing called silver loading, where basically there's kind of this crazy quilt system that insurance companies are getting a gigantic backdoor subsidy instead of a much smaller front-door subsidy from the federal government to offer these. And it makes no sense, and it's costing us a boatload of money. And if all we did was go back to the original intent of the ACA and fund those directly, even though it seems like it's spending money, it would actually save us $50 billion over the decade. And by the way, this is something Republicans support. It's something historically Democrats used to support before they were against it. This is just kind of one of those common sense rationalizing the system. So that's a small thing. The big money to be had, though, isn't in Obamacare at all. It's in the Medicare program. The Medicare program is the most expensive insurance program in the world, because it's covering the most expensive Americans and it's a growing population. And there's lots of ways that we pay really inefficiently in the Medicare space. Two quick examples, because I don't want to filibuster. But one is, if you get some kind of health service from a hospital or a hospital-owned doctor's office, Medicare pays a much higher reimbursement rate than if you get the exact same thing from a private doctor's clinic. So for the exact same services, you want a checkup, you want a dialysis, and you name your thing. If it's done by a hospital, we're paying more. That makes no sense, and it causes consolidation. It gets hospitals buying up doctors' clinics. Secondly, there's this private alternative to Medicare called Medicare Advantage. Government pays, insurance companies, private insurance companies run it. It's supposed to be more efficient than traditional Medicare, and in many ways it is. But the insurance companies aren't sharing the efficiency gains with the federal government. In fact, they found all sorts of ways to charge the federal government a lot more by basically lying about how sick their enrollees are. And this is adding tremendously to Medicare's overall cost, but barely improving its overall value.
How much does fraud play a part in this?
Yeah, I think fraud is pretty significant if you define it, you know, broadly. Literal fraud, where people are kind of using fake names and getting tons of money, is a little bit smaller. The kind of fraud we said there recently, the government kind of exposed a ring where providers were recommending skin grafts to people that didn't actually need skin grafts because the reimbursement rate was so high. That's fraud. It's not as obvious of fraud because people agreed to it. But I think there's a significant amount of fraud. When I mentioned before, these Medicare Advantage plans making their patients seem sicker than they are, that's a form of fraud. So I think if you define it broadly, there's a lot of fraud. There's certainly a lot of waste and abuse. With that said, we're not going to solve this with fraud alone. Mm-hmm. And to beat the fraud, we're going to have to do policies that go more broadly than just going after fraud.
How do we encourage, and again, Mark Goldwine is with us here, Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director, a lot of experience with fiscal responsibility and working for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, CRFB.org. A lot of good information. You guys do a lot of good research, and I appreciate that, Mark. I mean, we need a lot of that because there's a lot of smoke and mirrors in this. And you know, it's going to be political, and I'll talk about that later because I don't want to devolve there. How much does a healthier America help?
Well, a healthier America would be wonderful for all sorts of reasons. Like, health is good for its own sake, is better for productive workers. We want a healthier America. But I think there's probably a limit to how much a healthier America can save us federal dollars. And the reason is that if we're healthier, we're more likely to live longer. Over that period, we're going to collect more in Social Security. We'll collect more in Medicare in each given year. And then probably most people are still going to die of some disease late in life, right? Because effectively the biggest costs for the most part are late in life. You know, being healthier means that whatever disease you were going to get at age 78, instead you get at age 82. And so we should all want to be healthier. It's good for all sorts of reasons, but we shouldn't count on it to save money because if we're living longer, we're probably going to then have some other medical needs later in life.
Let's ask the question about does government subsidized health encourage that type of thing, or does it erode that sort? I mean,
right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, a challenge is that when the government does try to subsidize healthy behavior, it almost always ends up a windfall for something that makes no sense. And so we have these Medicare Advantage plans. I'm just going to keep picking on them because they're so expensive unnecessarily. They use the extra money to buy people gym memberships. That's great. Are they actually going to the gym? Not very much. They use it to buy people grocery cards to buy healthy food. That's great. Are people actually buying healthy food with those grocery cards? Probably not, right? They're buying the same food they were before. And so, yes, it would be good to encourage rather than discourage healthy behavior, but it's actually really hard to do it. And mostly it ends up, when we've tried, we often end up wasting a lot of money.
I got a call in rather quickly here, and we'll just address the question here. It's about Medicare Advantage plans. This caller had said his are going up dramatically. What's the cause of that?
Yeah, so, I mean, premiums go up year after year. It tends to be more steady for fee-for-service. The Medicare Advantage plans, their premiums in general are quite low, but they're also more variable because they offer different kinds of services each year, and because, again, it's the private insurance market. I don't know specifically why this caller's premiums are going up this year, but I do know, broadly speaking, healthcare costs are rising. They're rising because the price of healthcare is rising. They're rising because we get all sorts of new health technologies, things like Ozempic that are amazing, but also amazingly expensive. And they're rising because people are using more healthcare and getting more of it from specialists and less of it from their primary care physicians.
Are they rising because we subsidize them?
Well, the subsidizing, it helps cause those other things, right? And so subsidizing it pushes up prices. Subsidizing it pushes up utilization, right? And so yes, there's a trade-off here. If you don't subsidize something, no one can afford it. If you do subsidize it, some of that subsidy is going to be captured and is going to result in higher prices. And so what we as economists try to think about is, what are the types of subsidies that do the least to kind of encourage that bad behavior while supporting that good behavior?
And I know that insurance companies are a player in this. They're, I don't know, nobody wants to call them a victim or a perpetrator. And I think that's fair. I don't think they're either of that. They're trying to adjust to a system here. But I look at some of their profits, especially over the last several years when these extended subsidies have come in, and they're kind of off the charts a little bit. As a matter of fact, these insurance companies are buying back a lot of their own stock, making themselves whole, so to speak, at the expense of the American taxpayer.
I mean, there's no question that within these Obamacare exchanges, some of the money is effectively going to the insurance companies. There's also not an easy way around that,
right?
Unless we wanted to have a command and control model where the federal government is running the healthcare completely itself. Other governments do that. I don't think it's very kind of much the American way. And so to some extent, we can't avoid this entirely, but we can have rules and structures that reduce that sort of excess profit by encouraging competition. And that was actually the vision of these exchanges, is that there'd be plans that are competing with each other. And in some regions they do, but a lot of regions, the issue is there's only a few plans. The subsidies are so generous that it's very easy to enroll people. They don't have to compete too much with each other or for customers. And that's a problem for keeping costs under control.
Mark Goldwine again, Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director for Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. A responsible federal budget. I could get stuck on that. CRFB.org for information. We got like 2.5 minutes here, and I know you've got to go. I appreciate your time. And I'll pick up this topic myself. I have some things to share on the other side. How do you anticipate this debate to go when the continuing resolution ends in January and those subsidies are still on the table?
That's right. You know, we didn't actually even talk about those expiring subsidies, but the big debate right now is we expanded Obamacare for a few years, and that expansion expires December 31st, and people have gotten used to it. And there are some parts of the expansion I think were actually really smart, like getting rid of cliffs. And there's some parts of the expansion I think were really dumb, like providing subsidies to people making $400,000 a year in some cases, and providing a lot of people, not just some people, with zero premium plans that I think is encouraging over enrollment. And so what I would hope would happen is that we could have a rational conversation about what the subsidy schedule should look like. And maybe it shouldn't look like original Obamacare. It probably shouldn't look like the enhanced subsidies. There's about 1 million options that are in between. And what I would really hope is that conversation be a part of a much larger conversation about how we actually get healthcare costs under control, because we can subsidize until our hair turns blue. If we don't actually get the cost under control, it's only a question of who pays. So the question should be about how much.
I'm encouraged by this. It's within reach then.
Well, who knows politically, but this is doable.
Yeah.
This is not that hard, analytically. It's hard to solve the entire healthcare crisis, but there's so much we already know how to do. There's actually, believe it or not, President Trump and President Obama had 80% overlap in their ideas on Medicare. Truly, there is a lot that people already understand that already agreed to. We just need the political will to actually do it.
Boy, I appreciate that. You got 30 seconds on what else you guys are doing there?
Well, in my last 30 seconds, I'll say that in 7 years, Social Security and Medicare run out. So while we're, worried about the small subsidy cliff, the big cliff is when there's a 24% across-the-board cut to all Social Security benefits and a 12% cut to all Medicare benefits, and politicians haven't talked one word about that.
Oh, I know that for a fact. But we'll get them to talk about it here. It's on the plate on this program,
great,
that's for sure. Hey, Mark, appreciate your time, appreciate your expertise, and I appreciate having your email address because
thanks for having me.
I'm going to call you again, okay, sir?
Sounds good.
Thanks. That's Mark Goldwine once again. Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Thanks for joining us for the podcast. And join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.